The E-12 Education Committee will come to order. And good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning.
We're going to dive into a new subject matter today and hopefully bring some better understanding to the whole area of testing and assessments and see if we can't come up with a good, comprehensive, solid, long-range plan that will, that we can feel proud of as we look back and from years from now and say that we did the right, made the right decision. So I think we're going to start out with our own staff. And we have Shelby, but I think, oh, there you are. You're going to give a presentation and our council and get us started, and then we'll move down the agenda. Be nice if we had a full committee.
Doing better this year at getting here on time.
Because this is kind of, good morning.
Good morning,
yes. This is one of those areas that a lot of us know very, very little about, and it gets technical. So we might have to answer questions later on, or the same question later on, but I think we should get started because there will be lots of information, I'm sure. Ms. McQuaid?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm just going to give a brief overview of the issues so that hopefully when you hear from the other experts, the testifiers, that the discussion will be framed a little bit better for you. I'll just go over the statutory requirements, definitions, spending on testing, the grad test, and some short-term and long-term avenues to consider. To begin, the federal government has mandated that states implement a set of high-quality yearly student academic assessments that include, at a minimum, assessments in math and reading that will be used as the primary means of determining the yearly performance of the state. And that's under No Child Left Behind. The state requirements then align with those federal requirements, and tests are given in grades 3 through 8 in reading and math and once in high school. In addition to the federal requirements, state statute also requires that alternate assessments be given for ELL and IEP students for the MCA2. In addition, a graduation required assessment for diploma is required to determine high school graduation. And then the legislature has also asked the department to include a value-added component in their testing program. And this question of one test has been posed by Mr. Pagel and others at last session's education hearings in the Education Policy Committee. Currently, the state assessment measures three pieces of information: mastery of the K-12 standards, proficiency for the purposes of NCLB, and the graduation requirement for high school graduation. In addition, policymakers have expressed interest in having a test that informs about college readiness. College readiness, though, requires a stable instrument, and something like the MCA2, which is based on standards, is something that's constantly in flux, and that may not be necessarily a bad thing because you want to adapt your standards. But for the purposes of college acceptance, they're looking for more of a stable instrument and something that can be used across many states.
Sorry.
Policymakers have also expressed interest in having a test inform instruction. And this would require quick results. But unfortunately, the April administration of the MCA2, the schools don't get the results until the summer or so after the program or after the end of the school year. So just some testing terms before I get into the short-term and long-term avenues will help frame the discussion. I think we hear these definitions a lot, but we're not quite sure what they mean, so I'm just trying to elaborate here. So we hear summative, formative, and adaptive assessments. And a summative assessment is something like the MCA2. It's given at a particular point in time to determine what students do and do not know, It's meant to assess program outcomes or impacts, and it's the type of test that's required by NCLB. A formative assessment, on the other hand, is something like the NWEA, MAP, or RTI, and these are assessments that are part of the instructional process. They inform teachers and students about student understanding, and they can address questions about implementation and planning. The Council of Chief State School Officers says an assessment is formative to the extent that information from the assessment is used during the instructional segment in which the segment occurred, the assessment occurred, to adjust instruction with the intent of better meeting the needs of students assessed. And this type of assessment is not allowed under NCLB. An adaptive test is something like the NWEA or MAP, which adjusts the level of difficulty. So it begins testing at one level and adjusts the questions, the level of difficulty, upward or downward, depending on the performance of the student. This gives a measure of it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Quaid, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Quaid, when you say it's not allowed under NCLB, it doesn't meet the requirements, but it's not prohibited from schools can use them. Is that...
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yeah, it's not it's not allowed for determining adequate yearly progress, but still schools can use it.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. McQuaid.
Mr. Chair, the adaptive test gives a measure of achievement that's but it's not necessarily a measure of grade level, although it could be. And this type of test is also not allowed for the purposes of AYP, but it is allowed, schools are allowed to use it. Two additional definitions that I think will help frame the discussion are stakes and pressure. A low-stakes test is something that does not determine graduation or another indicator like college acceptance, whereas a high-stakes test does determine graduation. A high-stakes test can be both be either low pressure, something that test that most students will pass, or high pressure, where the level of rigor is a little higher and many are anticipated to struggle. The BSD was an example of a low-pressure, high-stakes test where it did determine graduation, but it was something that it was a test that most students were able to pass. So just quickly, I'll mention the budget, and I know Dr. Mattson is going to go into this as well, but the fiscal year appropriations for statewide testing have increased from $9 million to $1.15 million from fiscal year 2000 to 2009. The value-added component was added in 2006, and for 2 years it was included in the agency budget, and then in 2008 it was rolled into the testing budget. The total amount spent on testing, and this can be seen from a state funding perspective and a federal funding, both of these go to statewide testing. These amounts are not going to look like the appropriations on the previous slide because one, the total amount, the testing contract is not aligned, testing contract year is not aligned with the fiscal year. And in addition, this slide includes the portion of the agency budget that's dedicated to testing salaries and administration. So they're going to look a little bigger. The next slide shows testing costs per student. The MCAs, MCA2s in reading and math cost about $11 per student. The retests run for the grad will run about the same amount beginning in the 2009-2010 school year. Just want to make note that in the 2007-2008 school year, that $80,000 is not representative of the cost per test per student. It was the cost of developing the retests, and no students actually took the test that year, took the retest.
Dr. McQuaid, when you look at the costs going into this, are most states going through the same process?
Mr. Chair, there have been several states that have started changing their exit exam. Many have started to adopt it, but many are starting to look at other options. I think I would say that, yeah, most states are doing this process.
Okay. Thank you.
So, briefly, Mr. Chair, the grad test was proposed by the department in the 2007 legislative session. It was passed that same session by the House, Senate, and signed by the governor. It is a test that's embedded in the MCA2 in reading and in math. It consists of 40 questions, and the cut score for the math portion will be set in the April administration of the test.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McQuaid, was the grad test 2007 or 2005 legislature? 2005?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rummel, I believe it was 2007, but yes, it was.
Go ahead.
And I'll just hand it over to Mr. Cordy, who will hear some of the legal implications.
Mr. Chair, Senators.
Council.
There's two main issues when it comes to the grad test legally. One is equal protection. The other one is due process. Education is a fundamental right that's guaranteed by the Equal Protection Clause of the Minnesota Constitution. So when it comes to mandatory assessment testing, which is tied to graduation or high-stakes testing, as we've been calling it, some courts have held that equal protection requires that the state provide equal and adequate test preparation to every student. Basically that the state needs to give every student the equal and adequate opportunity to pass that test. So how do you define equal and adequate? The courts that have heard issues similar to ours have held that if test preparation curricula in lower income districts or districts with high minority enrollment are insufficient when compared to higher income white districts, a specter of an equal protection violation can be raised. What are the remedies that are imposed when an equal protection violation arises? No court has ordered that a district has to grant diplomas across the board. That has never happened. The more common remedy is that the courts will enjoin a district or a state as a whole from denying diplomas based on test scores until statewide curricula are aligned and there's equal and adequate remediation statewide. In Minnesota, no court has heard an issue such as this, an equal protection case like this, so there's no way to know how a state judge would rule in this case if they'd be convinced that the current testing regime is violative of equal protection. Second issue is due process. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution requires that the government supply notice of any government-imposed deprivation of life, liberty, or property. The United States Supreme Court has held that education is a property interest that's protected by the Due Process Clause. One court in particular, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, has held that if a test is tied to graduation, procedural due process requires that students be given sufficient notice of the test standards to allow students adequate preparation time. So again, what constitutes sufficient notice? Well, the department has pointed out that the class of 2010 will have had 4 years of statutory notice of the high-stakes nature of the grad test. This is true. Some parties who you'll hear from claim that statutory notice alone is insufficient under due process standards. They claim that since the department is not releasing exact cut scores required to pass the math grad until after the initial administration this spring, these parties argue that the graduating class of 2010 would have less than 10 months' notice of the definitive threshold to be met in order to graduate. Once again, no Minnesota court has heard a due process case regarding these issues, so it's impossible to say with any certainty which side the court might agree with. So in the interest of time, I'll leave it at that. And if any of you would like to discuss this information more, I'd be happy to do so.
Okay. Any questions, members? Thank you, court.
So, Mr. Chair, that said, there's a couple avenues to go down in the short term. In the 2008 legislative session, Senator Torres Ray introduced a bill that would allow for a temporary 3-year appeals process for students who did not pass the grad test. And they would appeal to their local district, and that process would be, I think, was determined by the commissioner. This session, Senator Wieger has introduced Senate File 405, which for students who did not pass the grad test requires students to complete and pass their coursework participate in remediation, and take up to two retests if they continue to fail the grad. Another option to look at is just a simple hold harmless period, and that would allow the department to continue with the setting the cut score in April after the April administration of the test, but no requirements would be made of students if they fail. Similar to what was done with the BST, the legislature could allow for a phased-in cut score, and this could be done in two ways. The first is the analytical approach, which is waiting till the actual administration of the test, wait till the students take the test, and then determine the cut score after that. And this is generally the way that most cut scores are set. You wait till the actual administration of the test. Another way to do it, though, is to take this judgmental approach and get, a bunch of psychometricians in a room and determine what the cut score should be prior to the actual administration of the test. The caution here is not knowing how many students would pass or fail based on that approach. Another way to look at it is to take a cumulative score. And this would be something similar to what the ACT and the SAT do with, they have subscores in each of their subjects, but only one score is reported. So we have the grad test in reading, writing, and in math. The downside of something like this is high scores in two of the subjects could compensate for a low score in another area. Another thing to consider is to allow for retest 2 years following a student's senior year. So if a student does not pass the grad test in their junior year of high school, they have then their senior year of high school to retake the test, and they could also then retest for up to 2 years following their senior year and still be receive the same diploma that they would have in their senior year. And one other option would be to allow for a different test to serve as the graduation indicator. And other states have allowed this. If a student perhaps passes the ACT at a certain level or SAT or another college placement test, in our state we have the AccuPlacer, this could serve as a graduation indicator. I think this the downside of that would be it sort of leaves open the same question that the state is dealing with right now, is what is the cut score? So just a little diversion, sure, before we get into...
Dr. McQuaid. Or Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. McQuaid, this is just an opportunity for you to catch your breath. But I thought, as you move from short-term to kind of the longer-term discussion, I wanted to look over at my colleague, Senator Wieger, and I don't know if you have an update. I know there's been a working group specifically looking at the math issue, the math standards, the math tests, and timing. Has there been any kind of closure on that? Where are we at as of the first week of March here?
Senator Wieger?
Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, the group met several times and had nearly reached consensus on a short-term solution, which is reflected in the Senate file that Dr. McQuaid referred to. Not everyone necessarily agreed with it, because a part of the discussion is whether we would also buy into a long-term solution with the short-term, that being end-of-course tests, which we're going to have a lot of discussion on. We aren't ready to jump into a long-term solution yet. We recognize the sense of urgency on the short term, and so we do have an option, which I assume we'll be discussing in the near future. But for the long term, we want to very carefully weigh a lot of the options that will be rolled out today for some of the long-term solutions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wieger, that's a good description. I think the hope is that after we get done with this committee meeting, we'll all walk away with a better understanding of what should or should not be in, and it's primarily the long term where we're kind of centering. I think the short term is the options are somewhat limited. I mean, there's a lot of options, but that Dr. McQuaid laid out. But I think the more pressing issue for us is the long term, and to be sure that we make the right decision, so that, let's say, 2 years from now or 3 years from now, the system doesn't have to rearrange itself. And I'm hoping that we can all kind of bring ourselves up to speed on the options that are available, and then we can come to a consensus on the best of those options. So that's kind of what this hearing's about. So, Dr. McQuaid?
Mr. Chair, members, and I would just also add that this slide doesn't represent, it just represents a limited list of options, but I'm sure there's several options, other options to consider. And then first, before going into the long-term solution, I'll just lay out what the current process is as it relates to standards and graduation requirements. On the one hand, there is a discussion of standards, and standards are set forth in statute, while at the same time, there's a discussion of graduation requirements, and those graduation requirements are set forth in statute. And those two together are aligned with the test, and then there's field testing, and just a quick note, there's the test administration, and then the cut scores are determined. And another way to look at this, and this is the way it is right now as the grad is embedded into the MCA2. Another way to look at this is to have the discussion of standards separate from the discussion of graduation requirements. The benefit that legislators saw in having the grad embedded into the MCA2 was the having a limited number of tests. But if you do something like this alternative process where you have separate silos, this may introduce more testing if you choose to do testing under your graduation requirements. The left-hand side would, the standards and the test administration, this would continue to be the MCA2. So that said, and this certainly isn't an exhaustive list either, but in the long term, the state could continue offering the grad to juniors and do a phased-in cut score similar to what was done with the BST, and this was discussed in the short term, but could be continued in the long term. A second way to do this is to continue with the grad but push back the administration grade. So currently, the math test is given in the 11th grade, but that could be pushed back to the 10th grade, allowing more time for retests while still in and remediation while still in high school. Another way to...
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. McQuaid, if we pushed it back to 10th grade, do we think that our students have had the necessary math courses by that time to be able to succeed in the test?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, that would be the problem with that option.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, another way to continue with the grad or simply the MCA2 is to offer multiple cut scores to students. And other states have worked with this in their testing policies to, and this sort of lends you down the path of having different pathways for work readiness versus college readiness. And the governor has proposed an end-of-course test, and this would be in place of the grad for Algebra 2 and Geometry, I believe. The other way to look at high-stakes testing is to have another assessment determine graduation. And the last three would serve as an alternative to the exit exam. You could leave graduation requirements to districts for as a local decision, and the MCA2 would serve then just as a measure of federal performance or performance for the federal level. Coursework could also be the deciding factor in graduation. The state could put forward a catalog of courses that students would be required to take in order to graduate. And then states have also used portfolios, but they tend to be going away from this, and this would include a combination of courses and assessments and other indicators to determine graduation. And like I said, this certainly isn't an exhaustive list, but it does provide you with a sampling of high stakes and high pressure and low pressure options to consider. And I'd also like to add that the information in this presentation has been borrowed, like I said, from Mr. Bakel, but also from Dr. Mattson and Dr. Yeh. And that completes the presentation.
Any questions? Great. I think we'll move into Mr. Mattson. And thank you very much, Dr. McQuaid and Mr. Courtney. Okay. Mattson?
Okay. Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Dirk Mattson, I work in the Assessment Division of the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm going to take you through kind of a brief tour, a very brief history of assessments, and then talk in a bit more detail about the governor's proposal for both high school and 3-8 assessments. Give you a picture of where we're heading, and I will talk a little bit about costs, but I hope to move through those quickly unless you'd like to stop for Dr. McQuaid's presentation. 95 is when we began testing in earnest in Minnesota in recent past when the BST was developed, and that was the single and only test at that time. We had a plethora of activity in the next six-year period, and from 97 to 2003, where grades 3, 5, and 7 came online with the MCAs, and also high school tests in 10 and 11. And these tests actually developed under IASA, or the reauthorization of what is now No Child Left Behind, but at that time under the Clinton administration, having assessments at various levels, so at elementary, middle, and high school. In 2002, we're all very well aware of NCLB being implemented, and that required assessments at 3-8 and also at high school, as well as science tests at the various levels. And at the state level, I should note, we also do English language proficiency assessment, and that is used for state funding purposes, according to statute, and also for No Child Left Behind implementation. In 05, there was legislation that phased out the BST and then replaced that with the MCA-2. But as some of that, I'll come to 2007 in a bit. The grad showed up in 2007. In 06, then, all of the tests were brought online in 3-8, in 10 and 11, in high school, reading and mathematics. And that is what the state uses to fulfill its requirements under No Child Left Behind, the federal laws for adequate yearly progress, and so forth. In 07, then, the grad was added in. Excuse me. And that test was to be essentially kind of a retest or identifying the minimum competency against those high school standards. So if it wasn't to be proficiency on the high school test, then there would be retests under the grad. In 2008, we gave the first interactive computer assessment in science in grades 5-8 in high school, which was a biology test in high school. And then to tell a little bit of the history in the future, the current plan right now, the federal government has allowed for flexibility to develop an additional assessment, which would be a modified assessment. This would be for students who are on IEPs, so students in special education. And this test has certain requirements around it, but the state is, the department is currently investigating building this test. And this is essentially the test that, and I often say in presentations that everyone's waiting for. This is the test for students who are behind 2 or 3 years in reading ability, et cetera, and this test can be used for accountability purposes. Also, as I believe was at least referenced, that in 2011 is by statute the first year that the MCAs need to be aligned to the 2007 standard. So there'll be some other work that's going on there as well. Just to let you know a little bit about the committees that advise the department, there are, I believe, 9 at current count on that are advising regarding assessment. There is an accommodations advisory review panel, which is actually to start up this summer, and that is a formal process by which we'll review accommodations that are requested for being implemented across the state in our assessments. Some of you, I know, serve on the Assessment and Accountability Stakeholder Committee, which is a group of stakeholders that the commissioner chairs. By statute, we are required to have an assessment advisory committee, which reviews all assessments, at least not the actual tests, but at least the plans for implementation. We have assessment advisory panels, and this is over 2,000 teachers that come together and review every test question that's placed on a test, every passage that's placed on a test. Minnesota teachers review those before they count for student scores. We have a limited English proficiency assessment advisory committee, which looks specifically at the issues related to those students. We have a local assessment and accountability advisory committee, which looks at policy matters related to state assessment. The Minnesota Educational Technology Task Force, which I know Senator Bonoff has been involved in very deeply. It's not specifically to assessment, but it does decisions there do make and advise on assessment processes. We have a group of national testing experts that advise us three times a year. They come to Minnesota, as all states actually have this process, to review our testing program and policy and psychometric decisions that are made. And then finally, there is a technology work group that advises us about the implementation for our online tests.
Dr. Mattson, I have a question here. Senator Wieger. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Mattson, going back to the timeline of federal and state actions, the recent federal stimulus package also addresses assessments. And can you give us just an overview of what the implications would be for Minnesota? We had a briefing yesterday in higher ed on the stimulus package, and it mentioned education in general, the various packages. And we just got a couple of paragraphs regarding the assessments. But what are the implications for us from the recently passed law?
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wieger, like all of you, just learning bits and pieces about that, my understanding about what dollars can be used for assessment specifically, and again, this is, I'll be glad to be corrected if somebody has better information, is that it's specifically tied to assessments that deal with students with IEPs or students in special education and those students for limited English proficiency. That's my understanding of it right now. So it isn't a broad sweeping investment in assessment from the federal level. Now, if as we look at that and see if that's available, we are looking at those other assessments, either that modified test that I talked about for 2011, or there's also conversation that our limited English proficiency assessment may have served its time. It's been with us for a number of years. Stakeholders that advisory committee is asking for us to adopt a newer test. So I'd be glad to come back with more detail as I understand it.
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wieger, in addition to those dollars or those uses, the state fiscal stabilization funds, of which we're anticipating about $821 million in Minnesota, which was not included in the forecast, an allowable use of those data is for a state to spend it on longitudinal allowable use of those dollars is for a state to spend it on longitudinal data, which would tie into the testing regime. So the federal government has said that's an allowable use by states.
Thank you.
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, and just to add on to Mr. Nauman's point, that's correct that it would give us the ability to house this information. However, the actual development and administration of that would not be a part of those dollars. So to my understanding of that. Just to, again, Dr. McQuay went over the costs with you, and I'll just give you some pictures of costs, and certainly see some increases. This is all costs over the past 10 years, and we certainly do have a spike up in the relatively soon after the NCLB era, and that is we are developing a number of tests for a number of specialized student situations. So I'll give you a different picture of that. Here are the tests that have been added since that time. Now, you get to 2009, there are 45 different assessments, and that's if you count reading grade 3, reading grade 4, reading grade 5, and these all have separate items, and it's a separate process to develop them. So there are a number of tests. Again, no one student is taking more than one reading test, so we do not ask one student to take 45 tests to be certain. So here's a different picture of those costs against the number of tests that we're developing. Now, this is very rough, and there's probably way more detail in the weeds that I could go into, but we have had an increase in spending, but we've been able to pull back down through efficiencies, even though we've increased the number of tests. So we believe we've been making some strides in that regard and working with our districts to make some efficiencies in the program and the process. And so we've, like I say, this graph to me is you can definitely see in 2005 a spike because we are adding three more tests plus the in three more grade levels in math and reading, plus the science test coming shortly thereafter. Just give you a picture of this. Will not tie out to any of the handouts that I have because, as Dr. McQuay said, our contracts actually span fiscal years. We are reporting, paying for the reporting process in the fiscal year after it, the assessment was given. But this just gives you a snapshot of what we where our costs go. We set up our contracts by functional area, and this actually is an economy of scale that instead of having several contractors all sending out tests, we have one contractor sending out one set of tests, which reduces costs. You can also note that some of our largest costs are for hand scoring, certainly of any one of those areas for hand scoring, over $5.5 million, and also for production and distribution of material. So couple rows above that, materials production and distribution and collection. And in the governor's proposal, those areas should reduce considerably after we are up and running with that program.
What you'd think in 2009 we wouldn't be hand scoring. With computers and the technology that we have, I'm sure it just seems strange that we'd have hand scoring. What's the story behind that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does seem a bit antiquated. I would agree. The difference is our tests, along with many, not all, but many tests across the country, our tests and actually state statute required to have constructed response questions. These are the questions where students explain their answers. And our tests roughly are between 15, 20, 25% of the test is constructed response. Those are where, again, students are actually writing their answer. It's showing their work in a math problem, for example, and they get credit up to 1 to 4 points, depending on what grade it is, for how well they've demonstrated their explaining their reasoning. And they're scored by rubrics, and these are all scored by humans. There is no technology, although I know the service providers are working very diligently at it, there's no technology yet that can read every student's handwriting and arrows and as you can picture a student doing work on a document. These also, so there is the hand scoring, and also there's a number of quality checks that are involved there too. It's not just scored by one person necessarily. We do this as economically as possible, but we want to make sure that that particular scorer is not getting tired after lunch, et cetera. And so we have kind of checks where some of these are fed back through and checked by a second person. Not all of them on this test. On the graduation test, they are, but on the MCA2s, not so much. So short answer, I hope.
I understand that, but it just seems like that's an awful lot of money. And is the benefit justified in terms of not the knowledge that the student has, but is the outcome actually worth that cost? Senator Salzman had a question, and then Senator Bonham.
And on that point, Mr. Chair, there is a facility about 5 blocks from my home that in the past has been used to do some of the scoring up of these tests. And I think it was from Minnesota, but I think they also work with other states. And the building is empty for about 10 months a year. And for 2 months, there are cars all over the place. Many of my friends have been hired to work for this company and score tests. And I think with all of these areas with these tests, my question was going to be is which of these tests really help us in terms of student achievement? Again, if we're spending $5.5 million on hand scoring, the students don't get their tests back. They don't get any sort of reflection on how could I have improved my writing. And I think one of the best courses that my son took in college was when he took his freshman writing class, and they kept taking the same piece and working off of that, you know, taking a piece and starting out with something, getting feedback, continuing to improve that piece as opposed to starting over every time you get something back, now write something else. So I look at all these tests, and of these that we have talked about with these 45 new tests, are any of them really useful to teachers in really being able to target what they need to do to improve student achievement?
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman, I guess my first comment would be there are, regarding the hand scoring, and this goes to the chair's question as well, There's probably in the measurement field, there's probably sufficient debate about whether these items are providing additional information. Just on the face of it, and we know, because I know back when the program went through its redesign in 2006, there was conversation about dropping constructed response, and it typically, and I'm going to paint with a broad brush, but I don't mean to, but typically it seems to have been the response from the field that, you know, those are the only questions of depth, they're the only ones that have sufficient rigor. So, under the governor's proposal, which I'll get to, we are actually talking about trying to use the technology in an innovative way to get at the same types of depth of knowledge without having to have all those folks parking by your house. and not currently our contractor, DRC, but they have been in the past. I guess to the point of is this test helping achievement? I think it goes to Dr. McQuay's explanation of summative versus formative, and the current definition and current design of this testing system was to provide summative information, was to provide for stakeholders how is the system doing as a whole. I probably have differing opinions than I know others have testified in the legislature, not necessarily in this committee, of tests that necessarily will improve achievement. I think that question is the same as saying a thermometer will raise the temperature. It's the action that's taken by the teacher from the information. So the question is, can we get information out of our state assessments that provides quicker, better, perhaps more diagnostic information? I believe the governor's proposal does work toward that end. But I don't know. I don't think any, in my opinion, I don't think any assessment will by itself raise the achievement. It's the action the teacher takes with the information, and obviously that means it needs to be readily available to them. Part of the delay for the scoring and the results is that's the primary issue, is the scoring of the constructed response. It takes time for humans to read those responses.
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Matz and I would concur with the comments already made. It seems to me that the constructed responses, while valuable to really understand where our students are, probably aren't worth that kind of money, because I would expect that if the students get the answer correct, that we can allow our classroom teachers, who are right immediately with those students, to understand how they got there and to do the work to see their thinking, and expect that does happen in the classroom, that for the purpose of our analysis of where students are, having them just get the answer would be an indication of where they are on an achievement basis. So I don't think that's a smart use of our dollars.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And picking up on the conversation we've already started, some of these issues around what we are testing determine what we teach. And so I know with the math folks, they were very interested that teachers actually work on numerical reasoning, and the only way you can show numerical reasoning is having these kinds of scores. So if we are using our MCAs or whatever, our state testing for graduation, then it seems to me that you have to have these kind of questions on it. I would argue that we do not need to have the high stakes attached to our state tests, and that some of the comments that Senator Bonoff made and Senator Saltzman made, some of this can be done locally. If we have multiple measures that help us determine when someone graduates, we can do a much better job. We can do this summative assessment that helps the state understand how the system is working, but in terms of the formative work that students need for improving their work, a lot of that has to really be done on the local level, I think.
Of course.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of new to this discussion, and so I just have to ask a more basic question, and that is, of these 45 tests, how many of them are mandated by the federal government and how many are not?
Dr. Matson.
Mr. Chair, there are no tests that are currently in our system that are not required either under state or federal guidelines.
Well, Mr. Chair, since we make the state guidelines, that's why I want to separate out. What are the federal guidelines? What do they require? And which ones are more optional for us to consider?
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the only tests that are required under state law, well, this is Dr. McQuay pointed out that both state law does cover both. It kind of mirrors the federal requirements currently. So, but let's put that aside and just call those the federal tests. The only tests that are state-specific are the graduation tests. We are required under No Child Left Behind to do the 3 through 8 testing, reading, math. High school, we are required to do the science. We are required to do limited English proficiency assessment. We are required to assess students with the most significant cognitive disabilities in a separate assessment. The only one that would be considered optional at this time, and that last test I just mentioned is funded solely through the federal dollars. The only one we could consider optional at this time would be the one I talked about for 2011. That would be the modified assessment for students. States are not required to produce that test, and we are planning, if we do enact that test, to use federal dollars to establish it, federal special education dollars.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, just a comment as we have these two pages open. I think we're all kind of thinking maybe the same thing. As I look at the number of tests and the average costs, you wonder what the cost benefits are. I do know that teachers feel that students are over test. They feel that it's time away from teaching, and I didn't realize the cost and the number of tests that were out there, and it's kind of frightening. So I hope that as we continue our discussion, you know, I've thought that all along that some streamlining can and should be done.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Mattson, I thought I heard you say that the NCLB requires a 3 through 8 test and then more of the specialized, special ed and so on. The 11th grade MCA is not a federal requirement. Is that a state one?
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, I either spoke too quickly or misspoke, so I apologize. But, yes, it's 3 through 8 and high school is what the federal says. So the state has the choice of where to put the high school assessment in reading, math, and science.
Thank you.
Dr. Mattson, could you give us an idea, if we did not have the hand scoring, what would be the turnaround time on, you know, the test results?
Mr. Chair, considerably faster. If we were still doing it on paper, we still are packing up boxes and pushing boxes to the scoring center, and they still have to be run through a scanner. But I could see it happening within, depending, I'm going to go on a limb here, but I could see it happening within a week to 2 weeks. Again, depending on if I'm the last district to push my results down, then I might be a little bit farther behind. But it's certain that is the critical piece. The other critical piece I will quickly add is right now in our assessments, we do a vast majority of our work in the technical realm, in the psychometric realm, on the backside of the assessment. And that's purposeful because we want to make sure we go through a number of quality checks, including having a third-party auditor review the results to make sure that we have done those equating steps and those psychometric work appropriately. So that's the other slowdown.
Okay, to kind of expand on that a little bit, what's the time frame now from, let's say, when you get the results and give the feedback back to the districts versus, let's say, what you just mentioned? I mean, are we talking months of extra time?
Mr. Chair, yeah. We're talking about a month and a half. The testing window closes about the first week in May, a month plus 3 weeks, I guess I would say. And the results are distributed to districts electronically at the end of June. And that is also in keeping with some checks that the districts do on the data as well. Probably, again, without the constructed response, we could turn those results around before the data checks are complete by the districts, but still they've got that information.
Okay, so we'd shorten it by about a month. A little over a month. First, Senator Salzman, and then.
Yes. Just a thought, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, I was just sort of brainstorming here, is that I was thinking about when my friends who aren't teachers are, you know, scoring these tests, and they're trained, and how it's taking a long time, and then I'm thinking, well, what's the difference between them scoring a test and giving feedback and the teacher? And then I think about all our retired teachers who are out there. And again, keeping this closer to home and getting feedback, is there a way for a district to put together a team of retired teachers or teachers who are not teaching who could come in and really provide feedback on a much faster basis? Again, I'm struggling with, if we're hiring people who have no educational background to score these tests versus our professional teachers who are in the classroom, I'm really struggling with that, like with this constructed response. So what are we really getting back? Is it sort of an audit? Is that sort of the idea, that we're doing an audit? And I'm just sort of brainstorming here on, when you look at across the board to maintain a standard of quality, which is kind of what we're doing here in a way, because the individual student scores aren't really used that much with the public, is it something where our testing could sort of be an audit where selected students are tested in a district to sort of give some feedback to a district, where are you at in keeping your standards high? So that's a whole different approach, but at a time with limited resources and the fact that we really can't use these scores all that well to improve teaching, and especially for those kids who need to really have a targeted response, that's maybe another avenue.
Okay. Senator Olson, and Senator Roebling, and then Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand why we went that route, and yet it certainly is a complicated one. But the most of the kinds of things that we're expecting to put at a test are really part of the instructional process. I mean, teachers will give assignments and review those thought processes. But in a good test making can require those thought processes, but to achieve the right answer. My question particularly is, if we were to change our view that somehow at this level we have to examine what those thought processes are as a part of the assessment, if we were to change that, how costly would it be to use those questions but have choices, for example, machine scorable kinds of responses for those questions that, you know, they still have to use the thought process as they're working to get to the answer, but you have just the answer rather than the whole process being demonstrated. Is that a costly venture or not?
Dr. Manson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually we believe that, and I'm anxious to get to the 3A proposal, because I think you'll see a lot of what the discussion has been will reflect some of your concerns or desires. We believe that we can achieve that cost savings in the item development and not be able to ask questions that are asking that more cognitively demanding type of task, and be able to look at what we currently call in Minnesota, anyway, a figural response, kind of using the technology to do drag and drop or hotspot or clicking, and using the computer to be able to get at some of that information. So we do believe that we would see substantial savings in the long term on this. It will take some cost to get it up and running, we know, because we'll have to maintain the current system until we turn over to the new one, and that takes a bit of preparation work.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the things that I have been concerned about in recent years is writing, and I am a writer, and so I notice what other people write, and I've noticed that writing skills among our young people are not very good, and I have concerns that if we don't have some writing portion of a test, how will we ever know where their skills are and where they need to improve? And if we say that teachers teach to the test, then I say we need a writing test so that they teach writing, because they shouldn't learn how to write when they go to college. They should learn that in their earlier years. And I'm just wondering, how many, is there just one test that really focuses on writing? There used to be a 10th grade writing test.
Yeah.
Is it still in 10th grade? Or where else might we pick up on some of those skills and know if students are learning them or not?
Dr. Matson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there currently is a single writing test which is now given a ninth grade. The 10th grade test to which you refer was actually moved to ninth grade to try and balance the testing load a bit. So for graduation purposes, a high school student now enrolled would take ninth grade writing, 10th grade reading, and 11th grade mathematics. That currently is our only writing assessment. There was back in early years of the MCAs under the Series 1, we had a test, the MCAs writing test in grade 5. For 1 year, that moved to grade 6, again, to try and balance the testing load because science was put into grade 5. And then it was not used for district, state, federal accountability in any way. And so to lighten the testing load, that test was retired. There was conversation at the time about do we just spring loose all of the prompts that we have and say, here you go, and here are some of the anchor papers. This is how we would have scored it, and you can use that in your classroom. Mm-hmm. I think that's still a conversation we could have. My concern with that is those are certainly costly to develop, and we're getting ready for revision of the reading language arts standards as well. And I'm not exactly sure where stakeholders will desire whether that be solely a reading test or, like some states have done, they have made it a language arts test. I'll quickly add, too, that the scoring of those, the technology has come a long way since that test was originally created, and writing assessments are more and more being scored by computer. They can score them to a single prompt if the computer knows the prompt and we're not dealing with diagrams and so on. In fact, there's quite a bit of research out there that will show it's more reliable than the humans who get tired as the day wears on. They're more consistent. So I think that's, if we go to a writing test or whatever role that has in the next set of standards, again, I think that it would, you know, be prudent to look at how can technology aid us in getting information quickly on those assessments.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a word about the timing. I'm not sure where we got to the point where the tests are at the end of the year, and there may be a good reason for that, but then if the results don't come until summer, it's, you know, then it seems to me we're completely dropping any pretext that these tests are for the purpose of helping individual students and teachers in a classroom, because most of those students will never see that teacher again the following year. And so there's no feedback at all. And so even if we sped it up with the current scoring and did it within the same school year, at least the teacher would have an opportunity to see the results. So we really do need to decide, what's the purpose of this? As Senator Saltzman said, is this about improving individual student achievement, classroom-wide achievement, or just aggregate measuring of where we're doing as a system? Because, I mean, otherwise we need the scoring to come back to those individual students to get some feedback to those classrooms, or we're not affecting achievement in any micro scale at all.
Senator Anderson, I think you're reflecting some of the issues that we have to make a decision on. I think that there's going to be more information, if I sensed what Dr. Mattson was getting at. And then we also have a presentation by Mr. Spicuzza, who is going to talk about the kind of the immediate result feedback, certain type of test, the NWEAs. So, Senator Bonhoff and then Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, going back to what Senator Roebling talked about with regard to the writing, you know, we've seen that the SATs and the ACTs now have a writing component, and they get that feedback, you know, very quickly. I'm just shocked at how quickly we get the results back. So they must be using this new technology that you're referring to, Dr. Mattson. I don't know, but I'm assuming that. And so then, you know, going back to what Senator Anderson's talking about, there really are two purposes here. Number one, you know, the state needs to understand, are we getting the job done in our classrooms? And so there's tests that should measure that, very different from what is it we're trying to make certain our students end up with. And having our writing test in ninth grade is a long way from how we want them to write when they leave our schools, because I know the world of difference between a ninth grade's writing and a senior's writing, and there has to be some standard about how we want our children leaving our public school system that may not be high stakes, you know, it may not be a grad requirement, but we want to have some means to check that. And I don't know if the NWEA has a writing component or not, but I think what I'm, you know, coming to the realization, and maybe we all are, is that there's two types of testing. They're both important, and, you know, they both ought to exist. And that's probably what you think, right, Dr. Mattson?
Okay. Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate Dr. Mattson's response to Senator Roebling's question and giving us some insight that there is some electronic capability in assessing or in scoring the writing. It's hard to comprehend how that works. But do our statutes, do you have the flexibility within the department to move in that direction with the writing exam? I think the constructive response requirement was really related more to other subject areas, was it not, in terms of what we have in statute? So I could, or maybe Dr. McQuay is the one to respond to that.
Mr. Chair,
because we have mandated that, essentially a hand scoring requirement for some of the tests, but our writing exam has been, I don't know how you'd do it any other way, or at least we haven't gone that route, but I don't know that you have a directive in the writing exam that would prohibit moving to a electronically scored exam.
Dr. McQuaid.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it is for required for subjects other than writing,
okay.
The constructed response.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Dr. Mattson.
Okay, Mr. Chair, before I go on, I will be brief. I know there are other testifiers behind me. Just a couple of quick thoughts to circle around some of those things. No, there's no requirement on scoring. It says we have to include constructive response. It doesn't say the manner in which they must be scored. And so there are ways to use the computer to do that. I think there were some I just want to back up one comment, too, that we do have requirements for what these individuals who do score the constructive response, their educational background and so forth. Minnesota requires that they have a four-year degree, not necessarily an education degree, but a four-year degree. They have to meet certain training requirements or they're released from the project, et cetera. So just a couple of quick comments. I'm going to move through the costs here. I think there's plenty of conversation about the costs, and you can study those in detail if you'd like, or I'll be glad to stop at any of those. The premise of the governor's proposal and what we've been thinking about in trying to design this is talking about as the new math standards come online, as the new science standards come online, it is time to look at the assessment program, and there are certainly your comments are not different from any set of principals or teachers that I stand in front of and present on a weekly basis, I'm sure, about the assessment. Senator Bonoff said it very eloquently that the test system was designed to be a summative system. It was not designed to give student-level information. And so not necessarily, it's not an incorrect design. That was just the design at the time, as most accountability systems were. So what we've been looking at in the redesign of this system is how can we achieve the following goals. So how can we provide the highest quality assessment with the most information for educators that takes the least amount of time to administer, that gives the timeliest results? And as I have talked with my staff about this, they've said to me that's a Venn diagram. One staff member said it's a Venn diagram. None of the circles touch. It can't be done. Under our current thing, you can't give something in high, and you all know it, you can't do something very high quality and do it in the shortest amount of time. It takes a little time to do it well. We learned that lesson in kindergarten, I guess. And in testing, it's very difficult to give a lot of information and have a very short administration. I can't tell you a lot about a student's mathematical addition skills if I only ask one question. I have to ask several questions to be able to make the appropriate inferences about that. But what our goal is to try and make these four circles overlap or at least touch, but we believe we can start to get them to overlap. And what we've done is borrowed our design concept from our friends in Oregon who have developed a federally approved assessment system, which I'm going to describe for you. And we have started to model what we could do against that. Really, this is a quote taken. We all know that this is the way the testing has worked. You test for or you teach for a certain amount of time. The student gives forth a certain amount of effort, and we'll see where they wind up on the test. The difference here now is to allow the student to take the test when the student is ready to test, and if they have not performed appropriately, then to be able to remediate immediately and give back some better information. So how do we do this? And I've often said to groups as I present on this, and I'll try and be done in the next 4 minutes, you have to really set aside everything you know about how we test in Minnesota. You have to just put that in a box, because everything I'm about to say is not going to necessarily make sense or say, but how could you? And that's essentially what I've asked my staff to do, as we've talked about this. I don't want to know why we can't. I want to know how we could. And so what we will do if we do this on computer is to provide innovative items that allow students to demonstrate their knowledge and skills. I'll talk more about that. To provide a computer adaptive assessment that allows more precise inferences. Most measurement experts would agree that a computer adaptive test will allow for that. Now, we have some constraints under NCLB to provide it on grade level for accountability. But for diagnostic purposes or more information, we believe we could take that off grade level. Flexible assessment window. Our friends in Oregon actually have a window that goes from October through May. And when you have mastered the grade 5 content standards, go ahead and take the test. And if you didn't demonstrate it in October, you get another chance and a third. And they take the highest of the three scores. And we would be able to do that using a computer-delivered assessment. I mentioned that the number of scoring or another number of opportunities, so let me show you some real-time information. Another feature that our friends in Oregon have that we like very much is you're able to pause the test. They have enough security considerations around this that you go in for your time frame during the computer lab. You don't have to block out the lab for 6 hours for you only to take the test. You pause the test when you're done and you return, or when your class session is done and you return to it later on. This doesn't mean that every student is tested three times. It means it's an opportunity for them to be tested three times. Apologize for the screenshot here, but this again is a mock-up of what a teacher would be able to see on a particular student. Here is the scale score of this student, and here is where they performed across the various strand levels. And this is information that is available because there are no human-constructed responses that is available to them immediately or relatively immediately, next day, etc. A screenshot of what's available to them to even track how their students are testing. So at a building level or at a teacher level, how many of my students have taken this test once, twice, and three times? I'm not going to give every student this test three times. I'm not going to need to give every student this test three times. But there are some that I'm going to do additional work with, and I'll be able to keep track of where those students are. A screenshot of what this would look like in the teacher's classroom to be able to pull up their class. And looking at where am I, the blue bar representing where am I today on my student's proficiency rate. We finished testing yesterday. Where am I today? 32% of my class is proficient in reading. Where was I last year at this time? 79% of my kids were. So maybe I haven't tested as many as I did last year, etc. And where did I wind up at the end of the year? This gives it by subject area, and then the graphs below go by substrand. And so this is information, again, that if I find that my class is not doing well as a whole in vocabulary, as where this one is not, in the middle graph left side, I have some opportunity to remediate during that school year for proficiency, for meeting the state's expectations. And then at a district level, again, somewhat blurry, and I apologize, but this allowing the superintendent to see by school what are my average scale scores, what are my students in does not meet, meets, exceeds, etc. Being able to determine essentially your proficiency before the bell rings at the end of the year, and actually as it goes, you're able to determine what your proficiency is. And looking at how can we use the technology. If we just take the paper test and put it onto the computer, we have achieved nothing because all we've done is jammed up computer labs. But if we can use the technology in a way that provides the most flexibility for districts to administer the test and use constructed response items in this manner, where they're actually designing items or marking out graphs, we believe we can get at the same information, probably not with the explanation now, but we can tell on this type of question, do they know the content? So we can get at a deeper level of information.
Excuse me, Dr. Mattson. Senator Rebel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Mattson, is what you're describing similar to what most school districts are getting from their NWEA testing and comparable?
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would say this, again, I would say this mirrors most definitively our colleagues' NCLB-required assessment in Oregon. There are features of this that are similar to NWEA and their MAP assessment. A critical difference between those two, there are a couple of critical differences. One is we're able to provide where are you for state standard proficiency on that assessment, not doing a comparison against NWEA or against the state test, but being able to tell you whether this student is proficient right now or not. The second one is we have the items that I just demonstrated to you, what we call our figural response items, are items that we believe would get at the information that we've talked about in constructed response without the delay and the cost of the scoring, and those items are not currently available on the NWEA.
Thank you.
Dr. Madsen?
Mr. Chair, turning your attention to the governor's end-of-course tests at the high school level, here is a potential transition plan that might happen in mathematics.
Dr. Madsen. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Madsen, going back to the real-time actionable data and intervention remediation for the grades 3 through 8, I believe, could you just elaborate a little bit more for that student that's in third grade that is not at proficiency for reading, and what would this mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we would actually, we also have, under our current contract, and we would search for this under future contracts as well, that they currently get information about here is where you are, and we provide some, although this is not the definitive process, information on helps. We have curriculum and instructional information that's available to the teacher and to the parent as well about how to accelerate that student's learning, or whether they're below proficiency, or enhance it if they're above proficiency. So they can take action on that with that information at a state level that we provide, but certainly districts are probably going to be they're closest to the ground in that, and knowing exactly what kind of help or assistance that student would need to be able to improve their performance.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Madsen, you said the student or parent, they may take action. If a person is below grade level and they don't elect to take action, whether it's in summer school or some other remedial aspect, what's going to happen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wieger, there's no required action by the state to say you must be involved in a remediation program, for example, on the 3 through 8 tests. Now, the graduation tests, as we know, there are some requirements about remediation and so on. But the NCLB tests, there's no requirement from the state. One would hope they are doing that just as they are every day in the school, is looking at where student performance is and identifying what skills and strategies they need to be employing to help that student improve. The only caveat I would put with that is there is, as you know, the governor's proposal at the end of grade 8 for students who are not proficient on the NCLB test to have some additional efforts put forth for those students. But there is no – these tests are not pass-fail, the NCLB tests. They are – originally, and their primary intent is to provide a system check on how is the system doing in instructing in state standards.
Dr. Madsen?
Mr. Chair and members, then the end of course transition might look something like this for the high school math. And that is, whatever decision or policy decision is made about the graduation test, one would hope that decision could be left in place for the 11th graders at the bottom of this grid. So that's this year's 11th graders in 2009 all the way through 2013. Those are the students who are being instructed or required to be instructed under the 2003 standards. So it makes some sense to us anyway to leave those students, let them graduate under whatever policy decision is made about the 2003 standards, and reset the system, so to speak, for the students who are required by statute to take Algebra 1 in 8th grade and Algebra 2 in high school. And so this grid, there are certainly many, maybe I should fill in the empty boxes there, because folks have asked us if we're stopping the 6, 7, and 8 tests. No, it's just to ease your eyes. So those tests do continue, and it's trying to follow the 6th grader who is under that new requirement. So they would be in 8th grade in 2011, and they would take Minnesota's Algebra 1 content during that time. And again, the high school students would be phasing out under the plan of the grad, et cetera. What we have the option to do, since those students in 11th grade all the way through 2013 are carrying the weight of the, you know, the accountability system at the federal level, we can implement end of course tests. And these four center purple squares there are actually school optional assessments. So there's an end of course in geometry and an end of course in algebra 2. Everything in 2011, by statute, we are required to turn on the tests through for the entire K-12 system in 2011. But this proposal actually delays the high school shift by a few years, allowing us to get some more information about student performance in geometry and algebra 2. And what would happen is, under this proposal, districts would be able to participate. It would be a real test. It would be a live test, and we would probably come to some kind of agreement saying you've got to at least include it some way in your course grade, because we would want student motivation for this to get appropriate data. But they would not be held accountable for it under an accountability system, and we could do all the things that we're having those conversations about right now. We could talk about which tests are going to be included for accountability, which tests are going to be the graduation test, if there is a graduation test, et cetera. We could do the standard setting not before it starts counting in those off pink cells all the way down, but we could do the standard setting in the spring of 2013. We believe we'd have enough data to be able to make some reasonable decisions about what we expect for proficiency. So what this does is it allows the system to transition instead of to jolt in 2011 again after the conversations that we're having right now. And I could go into that in greater detail, but I'll move on for the moment. This provides just a cost presentation of the current program versus the governor's proposal.
Okay. A couple questions here. Senator Olson and Senator Bonner.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Dr. Mattson, I'm still reflecting on the Oregon plan. Does Oregon use their system for just the NCLB, or have they been able to use it for setting some actual grad requirements? And I wondered if moving to that system where you are determining more individual proficiency and able to use that, is there a way of allowing that to become some standard within that system, to become the grad test rather than the approach that we are taking in this state?
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the Oregon system, to my knowledge, that description of that, those characteristics are really about their 3-8 tests. They do have some comprehensive assessments at the high school level, as they're required to do, as we all are. But I don't know if they've ignorance on this as far as whether they've used that particular approach. One certainly could do that, and they do use it for NCLB. I don't know if they have not tied in graduation stakes. I'm doing my mental map of the U.S. in my head, and I do not believe they are a high-stakes test for graduation right now.
So, Mr. Chair, you know, one of the things that, as we, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, relative to the embedding the grad versus doing it in some other way, one of the pluses for embedding the grad was that students would take the MCA testing more seriously because they didn't know which questions actually were the high-stakes questions. And so you pull that out. It is apparently it's the case that knowing that it's a system evaluation, not an individual evaluation, has lessened the diligence that students have about their preparation or the taking of that test. So I see the advantage of being able to link those two, and if there was a system that would accomplish that, I think we both the system would do better if there was a seriousness that was tied to an importance to the student in taking that. And that's why I was kind of interested in what you were describing with that Oregon plan and whether that might be an appropriate consideration for us. And it would also further minimize the extra testing.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Just a comment, if I may, about that. Yeah, again, our vision of the 3-8 program is specifically tied to the Oregon model. The end of course, I think, is I've just got a few slides left to show you about end of course. Actually, most states are moving to this because it does provide more policy flexibility as far as what stakes do you want to tie to the test. There are some states that have this where the test must be included in the student's score for their course grade, and that provides, they find, sufficient motivation. There are concerns about grade inflation on the other side of that, et cetera. So there's a host of policy conversations to have around that, but the end of course testing probably would be able to maintain motivation for the students if appropriate policy were implemented.
Senator Olson. Yeah,
Mr. Chair and Dr. Mattson, how does the is there been any consideration or discussion of the end of course exams and how that equates with the desire to have students college ready? That if the end of course is at the end of eighth or ninth grade, and when you get to the entrance exam for college, they have forgotten that what they knew, whether they were tested by in this way or not. Is there a bridge there that would strengthen the retention, if you will, or maintaining it, that would accommodate that other goal that we have of having kids be college ready and not have to take remedial their first year or two in college?
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the standards that we're now going to be aligned to are going to be required to be college and work ready, and so therefore my assumption would be, and we will have some cut score somewhere on the test that will be a recommendation for college and work ready. Now, that's a long conversation to have with post-secondary institutions, et cetera. However, there are some ways that you could even work in that score into the course grade to be able to say, you know, this student based on course grade, if the appropriate governors are put on the course grade, is also reflects college and work ready. So I think that can be achieved in this end of course assessment. That is the way many states in their P16, P20 initiatives are moving. Again, it is a lot of folks to bring around the table to get agreement on just exactly which mark are we going to call that end of course, college and work ready.
So, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Mattson, the question is whether the colleges will accept that they're college ready at the end of eighth or ninth grade or whenever that time is, or whether they're college ready at the point in time when they enter college.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. The end of course tests are all going to be taken in high school, so it won't be at a seventh or an eighth grade level. These end of course subject specific, and one of the I would say nice features about that is the student takes it when they are ready to take that, when they take the course. So if they take geometry in 12th grade, they should be able to demonstrate college ready placement in 12th grade. If they take it in 10th grade, there's the bar is going to be the same, and they're going to have to demonstrate that at an earlier grade. Now, all of the researchers will tell you that means assuming math content is still taken or math courses are still taken. So I don't think there's any test that can make a guarantee in 10th grade and say, yep, we know when you get to 3 years later. But we can come a long way farther in this type of system, I believe.
Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Mattson, could you restate your plan to eliminate the JOLT? And as you restate that plan, can you address if you're talking about this immediate problem that we have as well with these kids who are falling through the cracks in your comments, have you got that incorporated into this approach?
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, the JOLT to which I was referring is the spring of 2011, where currently statute requires that all the tests K-3 through high school will turn over to the new set of standards in 2011. And so what that means is whatever policy change is made on the current interim for the grad is going to reignite some conversation in the spring of 2011 because those students are going to be on that. So what this is in the governor's bill language recommends is allowing the students who are not under the Algebra 1 and Algebra 2 course requirements to graduate under the MCA 2. So essentially change over 3 through 8 in 2011, but let the high school students, let those 8th graders in 2011 start up on the new set of standards instead of turning it in one straight column. Let the older students graduate under the old set of standards. So that's the five half cells or 10 cells, depending on how you count it, in 11th grade. I do not have, I know there are multiple conversations, and Senator Wieger already commented on them. I don't have what what the policy decision is going to be, obviously, in the interim. The recommendation is whatever that decision is, let that sit for 5 years and let those current and future 11th graders through 2013 graduate under that policy decision, and then allow, it's essentially this year's 6th graders to graduate under whatever the new requirements would be.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Mattson, the ones who are falling through the cracks that Senator Wieger's been working on, do you have an opinion about the best way to deal with them?
Is that, when you say falling through the cracks,
aren't proficient?
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I might add, this is the majority of Minnesota students
right.
on the math. And so it's not just a few students.
Right. Mr. Chairman, to that point?
But won't that vary according to where the cut score is?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's whether the cut score will be at proficiency or at a reduced.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wieger, someone was making the comment to me that the results of the past test students knew that they weren't going to have to meet that requirement for graduation, that the real test is going to be this year. So we may see a difference in performance, that there aren't as many that were low, because they know that taking the test this year is something they do have to meet for graduation. So that will be interesting to see what the results of that are, if that theory holds, or whether it's we really have a bigger problem than we think we have.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wieger, but I think what we'll do is try to move on and get the information from the other presenters, and then hopefully have, you know, good discussion on.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Obama.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Mattson, I still would just like the answer to the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, I believe the commissioner being a part of those work groups is, to my knowledge, acceptable of the interim policy that looks similar to Senator Wieger's bill. However, I do know she has reservations about that not being attached to a long-term solution under the governor's proposal being end of course. So. I believe that would be, you know, what is currently proposed is probably, I don't know if there's a Solomon-esque decision to be made here, or that we're going to have the right one to make. It is probably a compromise of various stakeholders at the table. I think it's probably a reasonable one in the interim. But again, I think the concern is looking forward, and not, as someone has asked me, how long does interim mean? And I think that's probably the concern.
Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, I will move very quickly, sir. I will move through. Let me just talk about the end-of-course assessments in just a bit of detail, and then I will quickly step away. Essentially, committee members, there are, across the country, there are essentially three decisions to make, and this is, if you look at either summary executive papers or if you just make phone calls to other states, they're probably doing one of these three things if they are doing end-of-graduation assessment. And that is either some kind of comprehensive exam like we currently have in Minnesota, an end-of-course test, which seems to be increasing in its use across the country, or a college admissions test. There are various advantages and challenges with either one of these approaches. The current MCA is a single test. It's less testing, et cetera. But in order to make that college-ready determination, it needs to be, especially for mathematics, as far into the student's career as possible. And that obviously causes challenges with remediation conversation. End-of-course tests probably make the most sense from a curriculum standpoint. It's, I gave the instruction. I'd like to see where you wound up in the instruction and the learning process. However, there are some, it does, one could argue it increases the testing. However, if I'm already giving a final and it's replaced with a different final, it might be able to make the argument it is a wash, at least in number of tests. There are a number of states that are either currently using the tests or planning to use them, and some of them are coming in on March 23rd to talk with us more fully about that. Massachusetts and Virginia on this list are going to be joining this department, and I've left invitations for that. Modified college admissions test, you hear a lot of this conversation as well. This also, just like any off-the-shelf test, cannot be, you can't put the key in the ignition and drive away. There is technical work that needs to be done to make sure it aligns to state standards. It probably, because it needs to be augmented, it probably will increase testing time. And a conversation with my colleague in Michigan where they had to do this increased their test cost from $19 per student, and he would roughly 300 to 500% by taking that test and having to do all the technical work on top of it. So that's one of those, again, if it's a decision that's made of policymakers, acceptable to try and implement, but it does not come without some hidden costs as well. This is their experience. And then finally, my invitation, which I've given you a handout on, we are bringing in four state testing directors, Oregon, as I've mentioned, and Idaho, that's often talked about in Minnesota and their experiences with adaptive testing, and then for end-of-course conversation, Virginia and Massachusetts, and I'd like to invite you, if you don't have time to spend the whole day with us, to attend just a one-hour session at 11:30 to 12:30 for legislators.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Is that is there a correction needed in the room number? Is that 118? I don't know that there is an 18.
Mr. Chair, Senator, sorry, I apologize. That is at the Minnesota Department of Education because it will be taking place during the lunch hour. So this is
it's not here.
No, ma'am.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mattson. And I think what we'll do is move on to Rick Spicuzza. And the Assistant Superintendent of Curriculum and Assessment. If you'd please give your name for the record and jump right in.
One moment while it's up. Good morning. My name is Dr. Rick Spicuzza. I'm currently overseeing, I work with South Washington County Public Schools, the sixth largest district in the state, just over 16,000 students. I currently oversee our curriculum department of teaching and learning services, as well as our research evaluation and assessment department. If you're looking for handouts, I apologize. We had a few computer meltdowns recently this week, and so this was put together, and I'll leave a copy of it for you to have printed out and just disseminated. So my apology.
Thank you.
Just to give you a little brief background about my history and why I might be here. I have worked in the area of assessment on large scale for over a decade. I began my career lecturing at the University of Minnesota in the grad department for school psychology and worked there for 3.5 years. I've worked with the Minneapolis Public Schools and Central Administration. I've worked in Moundsview Public Schools and now currently work with South Washington County. During that time, you saw that Dr. Mattson talked about 9 different committees that provide advice and oversight with regards to large-scale assessments. 2 of those committees I currently sit on. One is the Local Assessment Advisory Committee, as well as the National TAC. And so those are the advisory, 2 of the 9 committees that have been giving advice and reviewing some of the proposals that you heard shared with you today, as well as in the governor's proposal. In addition, I sit on the Minnesota Assessment Group, which is a coalition of assessment directors that have been getting together for more than 15 years and talk a lot about assessment at the classroom level, at the district level, and at state and national levels. In addition, I just wanted to preface my comments today. I was invited specifically to talk about one specific instrument, and that is how districts use the NWA, or Monitoring Academic Progress, assessment system that both or all 3 of the districts that I've worked in, Minneapolis, Moundsview, and South Washington County, have used. So I have a lot of expertise and history with that instrument in working with districts, working with staff, as well as collaborating with numerous districts in this state that have used that instrument and, I believe, touch a majority of the students within our state. But I do want to start with a disclaimer. I do not work for NWEA. I have never worked for NWA, and I am not paid, nor have I been paid by NWA. So my conversation here for you was more at the invitation of coming to you from a local perspective to share with you how many districts are using the NWA system. But I also hope that I'd be able to comment on some of the questions, and I was quite reassured by the degree and depth of your questions today and the interest that you're taking with regards to our overall assessment, and also what role does the state play with regards to assessment. And I think that's the critical question that we need to answer, and you're probably better versed at understanding the trade-offs of those decisions. But let me start with that there are federal mandates that are in place that states have an obligation to respond to, and ultimately we have to decide whether or not we just have to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and do what's asked with regards to evaluating students' proficiency to our state standards, or whether or not we want to go beyond that and provide diagnostic or classroom-level information, which are some of the proposals that were shared today. In addition, just before we go any further, I know that the last proposal that talked about an adaptive test at 3 through 8 for the MCA3 that was presented by Dr. Mattson also included end-of-course testing. I think in my presentation, one of the things I'm going to talk about is that assessment should make a positive difference for teaching and learning. And one of the challenges that we'll have is that with the NWA system, you have the benefit of both evaluating students with regards to status on national norms that are historically been evaluated and updated every 3 years, which is one of the highest standards of any national company with regards to updating their norms. Historically, you run on a 10-year average of updating norms. In addition, it provides you normative information with regards to growth. And it's probably one of the nonpareil with regards to giving the highest quality instrument in an adaptive way for people to understand, is our instruction, are our educational programs making the impact that we believe they do? So many of our districts have interventions, remediation. We have Title I programs. We have ELL programs. We have summer programs, targeted services. The ability for us to evaluate those programs requires something that not only has a pre and post, but can demonstrate whether or not the rate of growth or acceleration that those instructional programs targeted to the students' needs are really efficient. The challenge, I would say, is that when you move to an end-of-course test, know that a lot of the work that you've done with regards to the Minnesota report card and reporting out now whether or not students are making low, medium, and high growth will be broken. And that is going to be one of the trade-offs that you will have to deal with. Because once you break the system of the type of test as well as become so specific within whether or not you're assessing Algebra 2 or geometry, you no longer have a continuum of a scale in which you could evaluate whether or not school systems are producing the growth as students move from elementary, middle school, junior high into the high school level. And so I would encourage you to at least be aware of some of those trade-offs as we move forward.
Okay. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Spicuzza. I just want you to go over that last point that you made again, because we just now got the growth measure into the report card. Can you say it a different way? Why does it break the link between what we have just established?
The ability to look at growth across time would assume that you have a unidimensional scale, like a yardstick, that would be able to measure a student's progress like we measure growth as students. A lot of times we're marking our children's growth in a doorway or in a pantry way, and you kind of look at when they have spurts and where they started as a three-year-old, a four-year-old. But ultimately, that scale, that ruler, doesn't change. It doesn't matter whether or not they're 3 years old, 16 years old, or 20 years old. In addition, we have specifics with regards to norms about whether or not we have the bell curve about, we know that some student or individuals are tall. We know some people or men's typical height is 5'9", and people like me are a little bit to the other side of that height distribution. But in general, once you start out and assess, the benefit of an end-of-course test was articulated quite well. I just gave instruction in Algebra 2. I just gave instruction in geometry. I would like to measure the student's ability or retention of that instruction. The difficulty is it's a very narrow band of performance. Currently, we have a comprehensive test that is a wide test that's measuring a lot of mathematical abilities of the student. So once you start to break out the types of information that you're measuring and basing it or trying to link it back to a test at eighth grade that was broad-based, you're going to have some very challenges, and I would say psychometrically would be almost nearly impossible to be able to demonstrate that growth above. 3 through 8 shouldn't be an issue, but once you get into the high school, that would be more challenging, if not impossible.
Okay, it looks like we got a series of questions before you even started. Senator Saltzman.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and welcome Dr. Spacuzza, who represents South Washington County, and you have a group of parents arriving to meet me in 15 minutes, so I may have to step out briefly. One thing perhaps in your comments, not to answer now, but to think about, is that I have read in the book Disrupting Class, which talks a lot about technology and how we use that to steer learning, that how might we use sort of an assessment that's sort of a pretest to give teachers an awareness of where students are lacking. And I also think about there was an example in the book of where if students were taking a math test online and they came up with a specific question, you would know right away that's wrong, and we know why they came to that question because they did something wrong in that calculation. Or I think about my daughter who had the one-to-one laptop program in junior high, and her textbook was online. So when she struggled with a question, she could click for a hint,
sure.
Like I'm stuck here. So maybe along the way, if you see there's a place in here for those kinds of assessments that could really target what is this student missing, and particularly in math because of the fact it's a calculation.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Spacuzza.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, I will try to touch on those, and what I'll do is give you a little bit of an overview of the NWA system, and what you see behind me right now is what I consider kind of the four critical pillars of why it's embraced by many educational systems within the nation, but a predominant foothold within the state of Minnesota, and that is that it has quality assessments that are available at the district's discretion that includes grades 2 through 11, as well as some early childhood assessments that have just evolved. These are adaptive tests, very similar to what you just recently heard. There's a difference between a computer-delivered test, which would be taking like our 40-item grad test, and just delivering the items either on paper or on a computer. Adaptive tests provide you a more precise evaluation about where a child is currently performing. The question for all of us, and if you go back to that Venn diagram that Dr. Mattson presented, is that you have the ability to decide we could do an adaptive test and do it in a shorter amount of time because it's more precise and determine who's proficient and who's not end of day. So what you would have is computer adaptive testing, still meeting No Child Left Behind, proficiency decisions. The question is if you want, as a state, to invest in and go further to provide diagnostic information ahead of time, to provide links to the classroom, which is the second pillar you see behind me. And NWA provides a one unidimensional scale, just like a ruler, where students typically score at second grade from the low 150s all the way up into about 360 by college. The benefit of that is that we have the ability to measure students' progress across time and understand that that number is then defined right back into instructional strategies and content about a student's performance. And so that teachers are able to take that number, that zip code about where a child's performing on the educational ladder, and differentiate the instruction or be flexible in the grouping. But it's only if, obviously, and some of the questions that you had today, is if adults, educators, and administrators take action on that information. And so that's where the analytic tools about presenting information that I'll share with you a little bit further, as well as professional development. And all of these are available within the NWA system as a user group, and many of us within the state of Minnesota oftentimes get together, collaborate, and share that information. Just to give you a couple components, the MAP tests provide highly precise assessments, mainly around skills and concepts. The benefit of the adaptive testing is that we learn just as much about a student at the high end, or gifted and talented, high-achieving students, students at the middle, and students at the low end. Because the assessments, rather than trying to have vertical questions that are covering the full breadth of student performance, low, middle, and high, now can say, once I start to know, because I'm rapidly scoring that test, is a child getting the item right or wrong, ratcheting up if the student gets the item right, and coming down if the student is getting that item incorrect, I now will get 10 to 20 questions in different strands that are now horizontal. So I'm getting information that I can make critical decisions about the skills and concepts that that student has achieved. In addition, it's not just knowing if they've mastered. It gives a roadmap about 50. Usually we're setting up adaptive tests for students to get about 60% of the items correct. The reason is that as educators, we want to know as much about what they know as well as what they don't know, so that we can plan toward the future and start to figure out how we bridge the performance. It provides us diagnostic instructional needs because the precision of the score at a low, middle, or high is equal. And unfortunately, in most paper-pencil static tests, there's a huge error band because we only have a few items that are dedicated to the student at the low or high end because we load our tests to where we're going to make a decision. If I want to know if you're proficient and I have to make a high-stakes decision about whether or not you graduate and get a diploma after 12 years of education, as a State Department, as a test developer, we want to make sure that we're very accurate about sorting out those students. Therefore, we pay the cost of where we load our items.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Spicoza, do you see a value in having both sets of tests within our structure, the kind that you're talking about, as well as the end of course? Can we use this type of testing? I mean, I keep hearing that you can't embed our standards in these and pass the NCLB guidelines. And so for that reason, I've heard that, you know, there needs to be both. But just in terms of the best, you know, possible way to be testing our students, do you believe in both, or do you have a, you know, this is the way?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator, I firmly believe that there's room for both. And I really do believe that at some point, and this is my personal opinion, is that it's impossible to do all things well. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge before you, is how much does the state need to take on at a state level with regards to identifying proficiency in the standards and then giving diagnostic information or additional growth information down at the classroom level?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Spicoza, so we really could go an end-of-course approach and then let the school districts use this to improve teaching and learning and roll up their data on a statewide level to report on a report card.
Dr. Spicoza?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that the challenge would be for if you're going to try to roll up individual measures across different districts, not everybody's using the NWA system, and they're not all comparable. But if the question is whether or not you could report out currently like we do about how students are doing on an MCA or a comprehensive assessment and an end-of-course test, that would be it would still be possible within a report card. The only challenge is with the end of course, going back to my introduction, you would lose that growth aspect at the high school.
Dr. Spicoza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last piece is that it allows most teachers to make and administrators to make database decisions from a classroom, school, and district level, depending on how we decide to roll up that information. And because it is computerized, we are and our staff are getting that information within 24 hours. And the benefit here is that we can test at our own discretion three times a year, and we also have the ability to look at growth across those different formats. We also can use that information to place students into appropriate instructional groups. I think the challenge that you may have with regards to an adaptive test at a state level is that you also are going to run into policy decisions that are going to be very difficult in a long term to figure out how you're going to deal with issues about if a student, and you want to do a pretest, maximizes out on the test and is now proficient, why would a district want to test the student in the middle of the year or end of year if I already know they're proficient? Which then also, I would say, creates issues for you about looking at growth. Because if I'm a student and I'm high achieving and I already know it as a teacher, why do I want to wait to the end of May and try to run 3 through 8 students at the end of the year through a computer lab of 30 computers? So the challenge for us as districts is logistics, and it's also the policy decisions that get put in place with regards to when the information is collected and then what are you going to try to do with it. You've heard a lot of information today about formative assessment, summative assessment, and I would throw out validity as well. Validity is never inherent in the test itself, but rather what you do with that information. And I use that as an analogy that we will run into it at a state level if we go down this path of trying to do everything within a state-level test that also has policy decisions tied to federal law that may corrupt some of the things that you've already put in place. Let me move toward a teacher level, which I think is some of the discussions that we had about constructed response that currently is costing a little bit over $5 million. Our teachers do not receive back the picture of how a student wrote. We get back the points that the student achieved on that test that do vary across the developmental levels of the students. You heard that it encompasses about 25% of the test, but it's based on the points that are earned. And I don't know exactly in front of me what by grade, but the number of constructed responses currently on the MCA test are range probably from 3 to 4 items, and I don't know what the high end is, but maybe Dr. Mattson or Dr. McQuay could inform you of that. So we have a time delay that we could, in a computer testing, receive results within 2 weeks. Currently, it's about a month and a half. Mainly to receive back information on a subset of items that are scored on a rubric. And I think that currently the challenge is that in legislation we do have the need, and MDE has to design tests as it's legislated, to include multiple choice and constructive responses. My personal opinion is that teachers and districts are unable to use that information in any instructional or formative way. And the delay is probably not worth it for the type of information that we're getting back. Within an NWA system, we are able to define flexible groupings for instruction. We can differentiate based on whether or not the students are falling, where they fall on that metric. And then we can also tie it into reading material. And one of the challenges within our students is that we know that we can no longer give one type of textbook to a majority of our students because of the degree of reading. And so there's many procedures that we have in place to be able to provide level reading for our elementary students, as well as using technology to be able to assist students or for students that are non-English speaking to be able to access through the web or sounds. One of the things I wanted to share with you is a quick, if this comes up, and I will cross my fingers that using someone else's computer will allow us to do this. Teachers receive information across a band of information. I'll increase the size for you.
I couldn't read it.
Okay. One of the things that we often see is that in a math test, we have strands or pillars of information that we're trying to gather about a student's performance. Number sense is something that we test for our students up through eighth grade, and then by high school it no longer is an assessed. There's estimation and computation. There's algebra, geometry, measurement, stats and probability. And these are the types of things that make up a comprehensive test. But we also know that across the domains, and I talked a little bit about the NWA system that runs like a measuring stick of 150 up to 360. Well, when you talk about algebra, you would think that as students become more proficient or more skilled, the types of items that they will see or the types of items they should be able to solve should become more difficult. And what I'm going to do is just kind of span across for algebra, as you'll see that the items, the position, the operations, where they have to fill in the box, turning it into graphics, multiplication, formulas, functions, factors, and intercepts. The idea here is that each teacher is able to access the student's scores within 24 hours. They're able to change that score into a concept that probably relates to the type of instruction that he or she is providing in the classroom, as well as alignment to the curriculum and the standards within the state level. In addition, this is just a sample of the items, but there's a whole program called Descartes, which is just additional information about the types of skills that are associated with a student with a score of 200, so that I know here are the things that should be under the child's belt, here are the things that they're currently instructed on, and here's where I want to take them. And that is available for every single RIT score that a teacher would receive in the NWA system. One of the things that I mentioned, and this looks a little bit similar to some of the things that we were able to collaborate with MDE and the legislature to move forward, was to be able to report out on growth. And as I mentioned in my introduction, NWA has growth norms for every single grade in reading and mathematics that is down to the specific point, meaning that if a student scores at 200, we know a 200 score, the amount of growth they'll make from spring to spring or fall to spring, based on over a million students within the within the nation. That target is identified where 50% of the students will make growth. The ability for us then is to evaluate first on the left-hand axis to be able to say, where are you? Are you a low achiever or high achiever? Many of our districts use that cutoff, the horizontal bar, to be proficient. Are the students proficient on the MCAs? And then we look at, of our students that are high achieving, what type of growth are we performing? And one of the challenges we have as administrators within districts is to make sure that we do not forget about the full distribution of students. It ought not to be education just to make sure that students are getting over the bar at third grade, fourth grade, and high school, but rather that we're moving the students at the highest end and making sure that they're making growth for students that are well below the bar, that they're making growth as well. This system allows us to evaluate, just because I'm proficient, I want to know which are the schools that are getting the accelerated performance, and I don't want to be able to say, just because they're high achieving, I don't have to worry about it. And this is a system that has allowed us to do that. Let me give you a little bit of some of the ways that schools currently have used this information. What's graphed is that you see three line graphs, and what we're looking at is a trajectory about how students performed in reading for our special education students. It shouldn't surprise you that special education students, one of the reasons that they're identified is that they often fall below grade level compared to their same grade peers. And what we're able to do is show you in the red box the overall score within a district about how it's performing at second through sixth grade. Remember that the RIT score, as we went in the math, you saw that the skill sets became more complicated. Students ought to grow by grade level because they're exposed, have more opportunity, and have developed a higher competence. Currently, we're also able to link, if you will, the NWA system to where the standards are based on the MCA evaluations. It's as if we can take the Celsius thermometer and change it into Fahrenheit. Water still freezes at 32 degrees or zero, depending on which MCA or MAP. Water boils at 100 degrees or 212. It's the same principle, same thing. We're able to share with you, with those blue boxes and green line, where the reading standard is. As you can see, a majority of the students are well above it. Special education in the first couple grades tend to be right on par, and then you see across time by grade that there's starting to be a separation of the student population. That information that's controlled by the district about when they administer is actionable because we have this information when we want to dial it up, fall, winter, or spring, which, if the NWA system was a state test, we would lose some of that ability. Going back to the senator's question about can two systems exist or coexist, and I would agree that they can. This is just another way of looking at for our ELL students. The ELL students are in the turquoise, and you can see that there tends to be pretty close alignment in mathematics up through fifth grade, and then it kind of plateaus. And this gives us information that diagnostically that we can start to look at by skill. Is it a content issue within our fifth to sixth grade about meeting the needs? The plateau seems to be at least clearly similar to our general ed, but it's an issue when students are already below the bar. And finally, here's another one with regards to reading, and it mimics how the ELL students were performing in the district with regards to that fifth to sixth grade cohort. Again, these are different ways that we can provide the information fall, winter, or spring, and we can look at the relative position of students at any point in time, then to evaluate the way our programs that we set up are having the intended impact that we would like. Here's something that a lot of times, this is a lot of information, but it covers from left to right a majority of our districts. One of the challenges that the Minnesota Report Card has is that we're trying to assess and evaluate 100% of all schools, regardless of how the distribution of students are truly distributed in our state. The urban centers are unique compared to suburban and outstate with regards to students of color, ELL students, and poverty. And so one of the things that we're often held accountable for is whether or not in No Child Left Behind, there are nine categories of which free and reduced lunch, which is noted here as FRL, is to look at the amount of growth that we're getting. Remember, status matters, but growth is also something that as an instructional leader, we're working on to say, can we take students where they are and move them to the next level? What I've highlighted for you is that there's a bar. At the 50th percentile, based on the NWA system, 50% of students in any grade, depending on where they start, should hit their target, the way that the system's set up. So to evaluate whether or not you're producing better than expected growth is if you are, as a school, able to exceed that 50th percentile. So you can see the tan bars. Some of the schools are doing quite a remarkable job of exceeding, but also there's a number of bars on the left-hand side that are falling, and 44 is well below. Now what I've done for you is split up by site whether or not they're students that are not receiving free or reduced lunch or students that are. If you look right at the middle, that is our Title I school. Our Title I school not only has some of the highest growth in mathematics for its general ed, non-free and reduced lunch students, the green bar is telling you the percent of students, over 80% of those students on free and reduced lunch, are hitting their target. To evaluate and compare other schools, if you go all the way to the right-hand side, you'll see that school 47 has 0% of its students on free and reduced lunch. To hold those same schools accountable on a proficiency metric when you know that poverty has an impact on overall proficiency, it's why we've pushed so hard as districts to include growth, because that's a challenge for and a confounding variable, free and reduced only. But it also is an argument for us to be able to go back to schools and say, just because free and reduced lunch students are in your school, it doesn't predestine whether or not we can produce the type of growth. So let me talk a little bit in summation about why so many districts use the MAP test. I think it's because it provides such a comprehensive yet tailored assessment system in reading mathematics, although it does also provide some language arts and science testing. It provides you with status and growth norms that were unique to any other commercial test that was out there. And it has those four pillars that I think are essential for us to have a good assessment system that includes the measurement instrument, the teacher and classroom resources so that a teacher can take that information and act on it. It has the analytic tools to allow us to analyze the information and look at growth, and it has the staff development components as well. I think the other reason is it's not the state test. And this might surprise some of my colleagues at the State Department, but I would say that in talking with many of the districts that use the NWA system, I know that it has been a point of conversation about should the NWA or MAP test be a state test. I think for many of us, we would be concerned about losing the local control about when we administer that instrument, as well as the information that it's led us to be able to do to set up accountability systems that I believe have an impact down to the classroom level. It doesn't mean that NWA couldn't have a different instrument, that we also know that it has some restrictions on how it would be able to meet the No Child Left Behind, but I also think that the current proposals with the end of course, I'm not as facile with the current expectations, but I would be interested to learn more about whether or not an end of course test truly would meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind. The assessments, I believe, should be aligned. That we have national, state, district, school, and classroom assessments. They all play a role. Just like validity, it's not the instrument in and of itself, but I believe that each of these can have unique, if not distinct, purposes, and that's where I believe that they coexist. The question is of whether or not you need to fund or want to go further than what the state or federal mandates are. The main reason, again, in conclusion, is that I believe that the reason that NWA is preferred by so many districts is because it gives them the flexibility to meet the needs of their local student population and teachers, and then we still know that there's an external accountability measure that's evaluating how our system is performing, and I believe that that is the role of what the state can provide us versus what we can do at a local level.
Thank you. That's a good presentation. I'm looking at the clock, and I think we really do. I want to be sure that we hear from Dr. Patel. So, I think, and I see some of our committee members have probably had other commitments, but again, thank you for your presentation and the information that you've presented. So.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And one of the areas that we've had some discussion is how can we link higher education to any assessments that we have, and we have Mr. Patel, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I knew I'd be almost batting cleanup today, so I don't have a PowerPoint, and I predicted right. I'll try and give you sort of the drive-through version of some thoughts about state assessment and college readiness. My name is Kent Patel, and I head up the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I actually have a lot of thoughts about the short-term challenges you face, many of which you and other members have heard about, but I think what you have asked us to think about is a good, solid, long-range plan. So let me put all of my short comments in that category of long-range planning. I was down in Rochester yesterday with a group of school principals that we have convened for a southern Minnesota cohort of the Minnesota Principals Academy. And they're just doing fantastic work, and I asked them about this testimony, and I said, what should I tell them? And they said, tell them it's not so much fewer tests, it's better tests. Those school leaders are using assessment to drive improvements in their schools, but for the reasons that Dr. Mattson and Dr. Spacuzza talked about today, we can move a long way on the better tests. I would suggest that a principle that I would urge the legislature to keep in mind as we think about the future of assessment, that sounds obvious, many of you have heard it, but it's easy to forget, we value what we measure and we measure what we value. And I have seen time and again that once the test is done and the score is on a screen or a spreadsheet, we assume it measures what we really need to measure. And we have all of our discussions about schools assuming that that is the right thing to be looking for. When college readiness is the goal, the critical what we measure question is not just content knowledge. It's not just an understanding of what mitosis is or exactly what happened in the War of 1812. It's also the knowledge and skills that often go under the umbrella of critical thinking and problem solving. And there's a growing body of research that suggests that even if you can hit it out of the park on the content knowledge, if you don't possess the higher order thinking skills, not only are you going to struggle in college, but you're not going to succeed in a 21st century workplace. So the question for us is, how do we do both? We can't do one or the other. And you face two broad brush strategies. You can try and measure it through the tests, or you can try and measure it through the tests and other approaches. The other approach idea is one that's probably deserving of some discussion. For instance, Idaho, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Washington State, they all require high school students to complete an extended graduation project. The state requires it in order to earn their high school diploma in addition to their tests, and that project is supposed to be around these higher-order thinking skills and problem-solving. So there's an important discussion to have there. I think in Minnesota, we've taken the approach that those are strategies districts, of course, including individual charter schools, put in place. But that's one way of coming at this issue of, do you have the content knowledge, but do you also have the higher-order thinking skills? I would urge us, however, not to give up on getting the higher-order thinking skills through our tests. Going back to the premise of we value what we measure and we measure what we value, if our tests do not include that information, a number of you referenced this earlier this morning, there's great danger that it will always be second, third, or fourth on the to-do list. Many of you know that President Brunix currently chairs, and my team and I coordinate the Minnesota P16 Partnership, and we've had a working group looking at our science standards, co-chaired by Dr. Janet Dubinsky, who's a professor of neuroscience at the U, and Dr. Beth Awney at the Department of Education. And their report is on the P16 Partnership website, but to wildly oversimplify their conclusions, they looked at our standards and our tests, and they saw the content knowledge. They said it could be streamlined and improved, but they saw two things dramatically missing. Number one, a prioritization of the big ideas of science. The higher ed faculty and the corporate scientists at the table said, there is no prioritization of the critical concepts here. And the second piece was the process of inquiry. I remember one faculty member who teaches freshman science saying, you know, a kid can go to Google or a reference book and remind him or herself of a specific content topic from high school science. I need kids who can run a really good lab day one of their undergraduate biology program. So two big concerns. How do you have the big ideas, and how do you have the higher order thinking skills, the process, content knowledge? For a long time, we've assumed that tests can't get at that. Get at the higher order thinking skills. But I think that Dr. Mattson and Dr. Spicuzza alluded to the fact that we really are on the verge of a quantum leap in the nature of assessment. And I'll just use the term 21st century assessments to summarize tests that do more than just measure whether a kid can regurgitate. And that sounds negative. Regurgitation in that sense is important. This is not to suggest content knowledge doesn't matter and kids can Google everything and find out what they need to know. Just a couple of examples of how this is happening. In Connecticut, on their state summative science tests, the kids actually do a science lab. And then they answer multiple choice questions on how they did the lab. And then they answer open response questions on the use of the scientific method and what they learned on their state test. In Massachusetts, we talked a lot about whether we should have what are called constructed response questions, but basically an open field where you ask the student to tell what they have learned as opposed to multiple choice. Massachusetts, the top performing state in the United States by far, on their 10th grade math test, I just picked that one, 40% of the scale points actually come from short answer or extended constructed response questions. That very high-performing state takes that much time on their summative test for what are basically higher-order thinking responses. High-quality end-of-course tests are also a vehicle where you can actually ask these higher-order thinking skills, in part because the kid just took that class, and so you actually can delve deeper with higher-order skills. Another test that many of you are aware of is an international test called the Program for International Assessment, the PISA test. It's given to 15-year-olds in the United States and other developed countries. It's a test that doesn't just measure content knowledge, but it measures how this 15-year-old student can apply that to real-world situations. On March 23rd, we're going to be bringing the person who develops the PISA test, a guy named Andreas Schleicher, to Minnesota for a morning presentation at the U called the Conference on High Performance that we've shared the invitation with Senate staff. But we're also going to make Andreas available through the MDE Assessment Conference. I would really urge you to come to one of those opportunities to hear somebody who I would argue really administers the world's best test in terms of measuring the application of content knowledge. So So if that's where we need to go with our tests, could we at the higher education level use those kind of tests to measure college readiness? A number of you asked about using end-of-course exams for college readiness purposes. And let me give you a few thoughts about that by way of conclusion. First of all, Senator Olson mentioned the gap between a test that's taken in 10th grade and college enrollment. That's a big concern. The 2 or 3 year gap between when you'd take an end-of-course test and when you'd be applying to college probably means that most institutions of higher education are going to want to give another test right on the verge of application. A second critical issue is that our tests in higher education are intended to measure how well the student's going to do at higher education. And so what the university, and I think to some extent by extension our state colleges, would need to do is we'd need to watch those state tests, look at where the students scored on our state tests, and then look at how they do on our campuses. If we found that those state tests are good predictors of performance in higher education, which we do find the ACT test, the college entrance test, is, then I think there's a chance that we could begin to use state tests for either admissions or placement purposes or both. But as a number of folks have made reference to this morning, that's going to require state tests that are a very stable instrument over multiple years, which is not currently how our state assessment and standards system is designed. And so the short answer on whether we could use state tests for letting kids into and placing them in institutions of higher education is maybe. But there are some very, very serious questions we'd need to answer. And certainly for the university, one of those is the fact that we have and we want to continue to have a lot of kids coming to study here who didn't go to high school in Minnesota. So the likelihood is we're going to continue to need some kind of additional assessment. So by way of conclusion, I really would urge us to not give up on getting higher order thinking skills through our assessments. Because of developments in technology and the developments in psychometrics, it's increasingly possible to do that through tests. If we don't do it through tests, I think it's sending a message that it's not important, when in fact we know it's the single most important thing that we really are facing. I just conclude with actually an example that's not from education. I mentioned at the beginning we measure what we value what we measure. Many of you have read the business book Good to Great, and one of the interesting examples in there was Walgreens, which was competing pretty much with in the 1970s with all the other drugstores. And they were measuring their entire performance by, in terms of sales per square foot cost of a store. That was what that led them to do is locate all of their stores in the cheapest possible locations. They wanted it to be the rent is the lowest, and so the most successful stores are the ones who generate the most profit over the cost of running the store. Where in the book Good to Great, Walgreens took this quantum leap was when they actually said the metric actually is cost per visit. It's the revenue generated every time someone walks in one of those stores. And, of course, that has spread from Walgreens to especially Target here in Minnesota, where it is diabolically designed to get my 5- and 8-year-olds to want to buy everything at eye level as they walk through the store. But in Good to Great, they talk about how changing that metric, getting the metric right, was the reason Walgreens went from good to great, because they changed the metric from cost revenue over the cost of per square foot of paying for the store to revenue per visit. I think the issues, Mr. Chair, that you've raised through this discussion are that important. What we decide to measure for our high school assessment strategy is going to drive instruction and curriculum, despite our best efforts to say there's more than tests, we must do more than tests. And so I thank you for this opportunity to share some 30,000-foot thoughts about assessment and to urge you not to give up on really having 21st-century assessments as we go forward in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McHale. Senator Wiger?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, I know time's so short and everyone has questions, but Mr. McHale, should graduation be linked to performance on tests?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wiger, I think you forwarded it quite effectively, Senator. Graduation should be linked but not solely determined by a performance on assessment, especially if that assessment is going to be a relatively high assessment. We know that a test, Senator Wiger, in some respects is like a poll that all of you as political leaders are very familiar with, that there's a margin of error that happens, especially if we're looking at not just how the kid can score on a standardized test, but what they can really do in real life. And to have a single measure be the determinant of high school completion, to me, flies in the face of most of what we know from social science, which is that we should have a robust multi-level strategy. I'd add, finally, Senator Wieger, that the one thing that is very clear from high-stakes graduation testing around the United States is that the political pressures, I think you, Senator, talked about the fact that 70% of Minnesota students right now wouldn't hit proficiency on that 11th grade math test. If we make that the only measure, paradoxically, we create a great incentive that may force the commissioner to set that cut score significantly below what we know it needs to be for college readiness purposes, because it's simply untenable to have that many kids not be able to graduate. And so I think if we have the only measure as single assessment, we actually may think we're drawing in line in the sand for high standards and we've really got to prepare all kids, but actually, paradoxically, we may be forcing ourselves to water down the rigor of our expectations for all kids.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pickell, I don't have so much objection to colleges administering a test in preparation. The challenge is how our young people in our high schools can be made ready to take that. And you know, we're struggling with, it's partly our structure. You know, you can't take everything the last minute before it. Of how to, and whether your challenge to us in terms of assessment of measuring what we value and valuing what we measure, do you think that concept alone can do it, or are you thinking about other strategies that we should embed in instruction and progress of through the high school years that can assure that we don't have to go the remedial route for so many students in college?
Mr. Pickell.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I'm very glad you made that point because it's so important. I didn't even make it. As is often said, you know, you don't fatten the cow by weighing it. The tests are an indicator. If I had to pick the best indicator for a school that wants to tie instruction to college readiness, and I think Dr. Spacuzza made a compelling case for the value of the NWEA test of tying it to state standards. But the EPASS system, which is the acronym for the ACT test, the Explore test, and the Plan test, that the state does fund a significant percentage of Minnesota students to take. The kids take the Explore in 8th grade, they take the Plan in 10th grade, and it's aligned to the ACT. 70% of Minnesota high school graduates take the ACT. There are some schools, high schools around Minnesota, Senator, that really do a stunning job of actually working with the student and the family on the results of those tests to do what you're suggesting, which is to shape instruction. The good news is that all of our kids and their families want to go on. They want to go on to college. The bad news is that many of them are not taking the steps they need to take to be ready for that challenge. You know, Senator, that at the university and also with Minsky and others, we're working on an initiative called Ramp Up to Readiness. And one shorthand acronym that may help, at least helps me think about that issue of what do you do when we know where the kid stands, is actually tied to the acronym for RAMP. Rigor, access, motivation, and persistence. Rigor, academic rigor. Access, helping the kid and the family get ready for the nuts and bolts of getting into higher education. We can't leave that to happen somewhere else. Motivation, the student has to own his or her own journey to college. And persistence, the habits of mind that are critical to success, not just in college, but in the world of work.
Thanks.
I know we're just about out of time. Could you comment, or are you familiar with the AccuPlacer? Is that a tool that is looked upon as an entrance gauge, or is that something that isn't that useful for us?
Mr. Chair, I'd urge you to have our colleagues from the state colleges and universities come talk with you about it. But if I can summarize this, and as an administrator in St. Paul, I worked a lot with St. Paul College and Century College and others on that issue. AccuPlacer is used, and Minsky has done some great work in setting common standards for where kids score in the AccuPlacer and what that means for placement within courses at our state colleges and universities. There is a growing movement within high schools to use Accuplacer as a preliminary diagnostic, where you're going to end up. I actually think that's very intriguing, and I'd probably put it in the category that Dr. Spicuzza put the NWEA, which is a local decision as opposed to a state strategy. It's an intriguing local decision. I've been in high schools where they talk about that, and it's interesting. It takes the faculty right to this question. If we're giving our kids the Accuplacer, are we telling them they're not going to a four-year institution? Because it is not used in general for placement at nearly as many four-year institutions as technical colleges. I'm not sure, actually, that necessarily it has to carry that connotation. It's one more measure. It's computer-based, and so actually it can be done quite quickly, and you can get the results back very fast. So it's an intriguing trend that's happening around the state.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your quick and summative information. So.
Thanks.
We have one person left, Jim or Mr. Bartholomew. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I'll be really brief since we're over time, and I'll hope that as legislative proposals come forward, we'll get an opportunity then as well. And I guess I'll just make two statements for this morning. In support of Minnesota's standards-based approach, and the MCAs in particular. And I think, you know, part of the, why do we have statewide testing? And many people have talked about it, because you value what you measure what you value. And we have the MCAs that are based on our state standards because our standards describe what we expect our kids to know and be able to do by the time they graduate from high school and appropriately each grade level below that. By comparison, and if you'll recall Dr. Spicuzza's slide about the free and reduced price lunch, the target score was 50%. And anything over 50% was good. Everything below 50% was an area of concern. That target was set by the performance of all the students nationally who took that test. By comparison, our standards describe what kids need to know, say, at that fifth grade level. So rather than looking at the context of how our kids are doing relative to a national pool of students, statewide testing allows us to see how those students are doing relative to our own expectations for where they need to be. And those expectations through our standards have been developed in part through your leadership, but also the countless hours of hundreds of Minnesota educators who put those standards together. So in terms of statewide testing, it's important always to have our tests firmly grounded on our standards. It's perfectly okay for a local district to have another nationally normed reference assessment if they'd like and that they find it helpful. But really the key for statewide assessment is to measure student progress on our standards. And we have darn good standards. And then I guess the only other point I'd make at this point is, as Mr. Pickell pointed out, we can do more with our tests. We can right now, because they're largely paper and pencil, we have limits. But as we move to an online delivery model, as we've seen with the department's first year science test from last year, the opportunities to assess more, dig more deeply into what kids know, turn the results around much more quickly. The online delivery model offers us a lot of things that we can do to make it more meaningful for people. And for that reason, we've encouraged you to support the governor's recommendations to make the MCAs an online model. And I guess the last thought I'd just put out there is the $20 million that we currently spend on statewide testing is a lot of money. But if you look at it within the context of the $14 billion that we spend in education, that's less than 0.4% of 1%. So while $20 million is a lot of money, it's a very small amount that gives us critical feedback on how our students and schools are performing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Well, members, one little piece of information is we will get the information on the PISA conference, and then we'll share that with you, so that if anyone wants to go over to the University of Minnesota for that I think it's at the university. Is that right? We'll find out, and then we'll get that to you. So. All right. Well, thank you for sitting through a lot of technical information. Thank Senate staff and the department and others that have given a good presentation. So now we can go and think about how we are going to approach this. And tomorrow we have transfers. Okay, fund transfers and shared services. So. Committee is adjourned.